Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for that warm reception. It's wonderful to be here on the charter evening of the Blue Ridge Chapter of the Naval Reserve Association to participate in your festivities. The fact that you were generous enough to clap when I was introduced as the next senator constrains me to report to you that we are, after all, in a very special section of the state, and you should all be on your guard in this day of Watergate and Deep Throat. I received a call about 10 days ago from a person who identified himself as Squab Throat. He said he was calling for a bird's nest and that this was a very unsafe area into which to venture. However, I also learned at the same time that this was going to be an evening during which my Naval Academy class of 1943 would achieve a new distinction, and that was that Peggy Moore, one of our class wives, was going to bring, for the first time in the history of the Naval Academy class of 1943, a husband, Rear Admiral Mike Moore, as a dependent to this meeting. So I decided that the opportunity exceeded the risks, and I'm here, and I hope you all feel the same way as you look for the various traps as you leave tonight. It seems to me that the normal problem that one has in listening to a speech is that the speaker talks a great deal about the situation and then ends up with very little time to talk about solutions. And since we have a group here that has heard me, many of you, on previous occasions, and a group that comes from very like insights to my own, I thought tonight it might be fun to lay a base for any questions that you might want to put to me by speaking only extremely briefly about the situation and then talking much more about the solutions. I think the situation can be extremely briefly stated. The situation is that the country is in very deep trouble because we have adopted increasingly over a number of years the practice of not reporting accurately to ourselves what the facts are. And as a result, there is a great debate going on in which truth is striving to emerge from its crushed-to-earth status, and in which numbers of people are trying to put across the fact that the United States is in deep trouble, hostage to the OPEC nations with regard to its energy, susceptible to being sent into another deep recession the moment that the OPEC nations decide to increase greatly the price of our oil, likely to see that happen as a result of the frequently stated objective of the Soviet Union to bring it about through exacerbating difficulties in the Middle East, and unable to do much about it with regard to leveraging the problem at the other end, the Middle East, because we have permitted ourselves to become an inferior power to the Soviet Union, both in the strategic field and in the conventional military field. Now that's the end of my speech about what the problem is. Let me now begin to tell you what I think it is that we must do about it. And I hope that in your questions, if you're not satisfied with that terse assessment, you'll probe the assumptions as well as the proposed solutions. I believe that with regard to our domestic incapability of dealing with the energy crisis, with regard to the fact that 32% of our oil came in from overseas at the time we were last embargoed, and after all of the talk about project independence, it is 40% today, and it demonstrably will be at 50% in the next 2 or 3 years. We simply have got to get cracking with a major domestic energy program. We have within this nation, because God gave it to us, the capability to solve this problem from within, even without the capability to control our external destiny any longer. We have the capability to greatly increase the secondary and tertiary recovery of oil and natural gas from existing wells, greatly to expand the rate of production of offshore wells and of the Alaskan reserve. We have within the United States today, at present consumption rates, a 750-year supply of coal. We could easily afford to double the rate of production. We know how today to produce the gasification and liquefaction plants with which to produce the natural gas and petroleum substitutes from coal to add on to the natural gas and petroleum, for which the curves will begin to go down if we do everything right in another 8 to 10 years. We have the capability to greatly reduce our hostage state by accelerating the rate of improvement in the field of conservation through the provision of tax incentives, the insulation of homes and industrial buildings with tax write-offs, the tax write-off for the installation of solar heating for those homes and industrial buildings, the tax write-off for the improvement of labor-saving devices, or the legislated requirement for better labor-saving devices, as in the case of automobiles. We have the capability greatly to accelerate the likelihood of a breakthrough in the field of energy by funding to the level of our rate of capability to deal with it in the research and development field, research to develop the solar electric cell, or to get onward and upward with the fusion process, which 30, 40, 50 years in the future will give mankind the ability completely to escape from dependence on costly energy. And all of these things require a national decision to embark upon a race to the moon type domestic energy program. We have today a president who has labored mightily to give birth to a mouse, and a Congress which has refused to deliver the mouse in the energy field. And we just simply have got to begin to talk about it and get something done about it. Now, in the external field, there are a series of things that we need to do. The first and foremost is to match our suggested openness in the domestic field by beginning to adopt a truth in packaging policy, to begin accurately to report to the American people the facts of the massive Soviet violations of one detente agreement after another all around the globe. And within the consensus that has always been achieved in the past, when presidents and secretaries of state came to the people and reported the facts accurately and demonstrated through the release of the necessary information that they were being accurate, through that consensus, to begin to adopt the tough negotiating stance which Solzhenitsyn has told us time and again since he began to speak out is the sine qua non for those working within a closed society to be able to open it up. That is, he has said to us, negotiate toughly. Give us time. Don't constantly accommodate to the Soviets' demands. Make it tough for them to achieve success. And those tough negotiations ought to consist not of a decision to go into Angola after there are 10,000 Cuban troops there and $300 million worth of Soviet equipment, a mere device to put the monkey on Congress's back, not to deal with the symptom of the disease in Angola, but rather to report the disease to the patient. We, the American public, are the patient, and the disease is the catastrophic violation of détente all around the world. And the cure for the disease is, within that tough negotiating stance, to begin to put on the line to the Soviets that if they want the continuation of our grain sales, our technology, our trade, all of which they covet and are getting as a free good because they are paying no quid for it, that if they want that to continue, then they have got to begin meticulously to honor the agreements they have been violating, and they have got to cease outspending us in the military field by the 60% in the strategic field and the 20 to 25% in the conventional field that they have been outspending us. And I think there is a very great possibility that the Soviet Union would honor that tougher negotiating stance. Through their Arbatov Institute in Moscow, they monitor us every bit as carefully as a doctor monitors the fever chart of his patient. Through Ambassador Dobrynin in Washington, whose minions are constantly in touch with members of Congress and of the executive branch daily, they monitor us similarly carefully. Their Washingtonologists in Moscow know us better than we know ourselves. The very moment that a president or a secretary of state began accurately to report the facts to the American people, there would be a spike on that fever chart. The messages would go back from Arbatov and Dobrynin. Hey, fellows, cool it. The natives are getting restless. Practice true partnership for a while. Cease the conmanship for a while. Reduce your military expenditures for a while. Put them back to sleep. Because the Soviet Union is patient and careful and rational. And so the mere decision to begin to report honestly to ourselves would buy us time. And the reporting, and if I am wrong and if the Soviet Union rejected our tough negotiating stance, the reporting of that to the American people would secondly have generated the consensus to make it possible to do what we then must begin to do, to begin with twice the gross national product of the Soviet Union, to outspend them in the military field so that they will then truly feel driven to join us in reduced expenditures. Now, within that congeries of things that must be done in the military field, nothing is more important than to begin the rebuilding of the United States Navy. I don't have to tell this audience that in a period of 8 years, the United States Navy has been cut in half. From 976 ships in 1967 to 477 ships today, and it will continue to be reduced in the years ahead through the failure of the United States to spend sums equal to that of the Soviet Union. We've been outspent by 50% in the ship construction field for a decade by the Soviet Union. And I don't need to tell this audience that parallel to the debilitation of that active Navy has been the debilitation of the United States Naval Reserve. And the remarks that were made to you earlier tonight about the need to apply your leverage, I can heartily endorse. Time and time again, when I was Chief of Naval Operations, I saw us fail to persuade members of Congress through sheer brilliance and then pick up the telephone and call the key political supporters of the senator or the representative in his state or district, and within 24 hours we were astounded at how brilliant we had become. Your leverage can be of great significance. All of you working together to apply the leverage on your representatives and your senators have an effect that goes far beyond that of any member of the executive branch while serving in the executive branch to deliver the goods under our system. And so I urge you, frankly and openly, to apply that leverage to do your part not only to restore the strength of the Naval Reserve, but also to begin the process of recovering the capability of the United States Navy to control the seas, a capability which it gave up, as I testified to the Congress, by about 1973, and a capability which is less today, a capability which is about one-third, one chance in three, of prevailing in a conventional war. And so these are the things that I believe it is necessary for us to talk about in the context of what it is that we must do after one has listened, as all of you have to do time and time again, to how bad the situation is today. And it all has to begin with a truth in packaging policy, an honest disclosure to ourselves of what the facts are. We've got to recognize the disease from which we suffer. It's the same disease that democracies have contracted time and time again in peacetime, letting their guard down, and it is the kind of disease for which the cure may very well be applied in this exciting presidential year, as one Republican opponent to the incumbent president is already beginning to talk about it, and as I suspect the forthcoming Democratic nominee will increasingly begin to talk about it. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll be very happy to take any questions you might want to put to me. Yes?
Admiral Zumwalt, I saw today someone said that the detente is handing over their right hand for acceptance, and their left hand, they have a big stone ready to crush us at any time. He also said that the United States is a year from any acceptance of hostilities, while Russia is ready tomorrow or today. He also said that they don't need atomic weapons, that we are preparing for and building up for, that they have conventional weapons that they can come in today and sweep us out. And that is disturbing to me. Now, how do we accept those statements of Solzhenitsyn when our president wouldn't even accept him as a representative? I don't mean that he represents Russia, but our president wouldn't accept him to speak to him.
Well, I think, you know, with regard to the refusal to see Solzhenitsyn, all Americans reject that decision. It was recommended by Kissinger because he was afraid that his relations with the Soviets would suffer. One has to question why he would be afraid, because the Soviets were exultant about how well they were doing, but nevertheless he was, and he recommended that the president not see him. With regard to the situation, we have had conventional military inferiority to the Soviet Union for many, many years. What has deterred the Soviet Union has been our strategic nuclear superiority. Beginning at the time of the SALT deal in 1972, we set in motion the factors which made it possible for the Soviet Union to achieve strategic nuclear superiority. That is, we gave them quantitative superiority in exchange for our qualitative superiority. But we were not permitted to overtake their numerical advantage, and they were permitted to overtake our qualitative advantage, and they have proceeded to do so by doing everything that was authorized and by violating the truce, the treaty, and the executive agreement in some seven or eight different ways. And they have today themselves en route to overwhelming strategic nuclear superiority. Paul Nitze, the former Deputy Secretary of Defense, who helped negotiate the SALT I deal, has written in the January 1976 Foreign Affairs magazine, accurately and scholarly, that the Soviet Union will have a strategic nuclear war-winning capability by next year, and they will improve it every year thereafter. And the obverse of that is that we, who never aspired to have a war-winning capability since President Kennedy, have now deteriorated to the point where by next year we will lose the capability to deter the Soviet Union in a strategic nuclear war. It will not occur. They will use their military conventional superiority to back us down every time there is a confrontation, as they did for the first time in the Yom Kippur War. We've entered a new era where it is the United States which will always be outpointed, and the Soviet Union who will graciously permit us to settle for a modest defeat one after another over the years until we decide to do something about it. Yes?
In General Zumwalt, I was a junior officer while you were still CNO. One of the things I learned was how to do it. Fewer people justify my man hours and justify every dollar I spent. But it seems the American people have made several decisions as to what they will do with their money and what they will do, where they want their money spent. And apparently there is a large movement towards spending the available tax dollar on social programs in this country, and a shift of emphasis away from the military. This has been a slow, gradual, but very momentous shift in the past 5-10 years. I believe that some of the statements made by Governor Reagan, the Republican, who is a Republican opponent you referred to the president, was that Kissinger apparently is taking the position that the American people are not willing to spend and not willing to commit themselves to a position of number one, and thus we must negotiate from a secondary position. We have made a decision that perhaps butter is better than guns. What can you do if you do go into the Senate or as a private citizen to, in light of this background?
Okay, well, first, I think that I would question the assumption that the American people have made that decision. If you examine the political races this year, here we have a Republican incumbent president who is being battered by a challenger to a degree that is almost historically unprecedented, by always getting 40-45% of the votes, and a victory in one state and very probably in some more before the time comes for the nomination. And it seems to me that indicates a great concern within the Republican constituency for the shifting military balance. On the Democratic side, we've seen the elimination of the more liberal end of the vast array of horses that entered the presidential sweepstakes, and now only one is clinging on. The ones who have survived have been the ones who basically have not espoused massive social programs, but rather balance in expenditures. With regard to the position that Kissinger advances, the problem is that he advances it in private. The book that I have written, which Governor Reagan quoted in his speech about Kissinger's philosophy, is part of an effort on the part of many people to seek to bring this debate into the open. But the problem you have is that Kissinger, who has admitted this to numerous people in one-on-one sessions, will never confirm it in front of two people at the same time or in any public way. His philosophy in private clearly is that the Soviets are the wave of the future, the United States is the wave of the past, the American people lack the will. His job, therefore, is to get the best, second-best relationship he can get. And if we could get him to admit that and let it be debated, he'd be rejected overwhelmingly by the American people. I've had the opportunity to be on now 22 campuses in the last year and a half. And on those campuses where I have asked how many believe defense budgets should be cut, every hand goes up. But when I ask how many believe that America should be militarily inferior to the Soviet Union, almost no hands go up. The problem is to get the President of the United States, while running for re-election, to admit the facts, and to get his Secretary of State to admit the facts. Yes?
And well, I'm concerned with your energy policy in that you seem to admit that the proper amount of investment in alternative energy sources have not been forthcoming. And you also seem to think that a federal task force on a race to the moon type basis will bring the proper investment in alternative energy sources. And do you not think that the private market can handle the investment that is necessary if we would get rid of something like the fixed prices on old oil, et cetera, which is now more or less restraining the profitability that could be made in alternative energy sources? And I just wonder, do you think that the federal government ought to enter this field in such a way that they are doing a race to the moon type task force, other than letting the free market itself, with getting rid of all old oil and new oil price constraints? It just seems to me that the private market could handle this problem if we did not have federal government entering the energy field.
I don't advocate a federal task force to do the job of the production of the energy. I don't think there is any way to achieve conservation of energy without federal incentives, federally provided incentives, tax incentives. I don't think there is any way to get the gasification and liquefaction plants built until free enterprise is guaranteed the protection that they must be guaranteed against the obvious counter tactic of the OPEC nations to reduce their prices. It costs the Saudi Arabians 15 cents to produce a barrel of oil. They're charging us $12 or more for it. The minute they saw us investing billions in gasification and liquefaction plants, which would cost in excess of that to produce a barrel of oil, they would reduce their prices to try to destroy those capital investments. So the federal government has to provide the protection for those investments in terms of a guaranteed procurement of so many millions of barrels per year for the Navy, or in terms of an insurance for the initial investments, or in some way to do what the government has done for 100 years for free enterprise, to make it possible for it to survive under conditions of unfair competition. It's that kind of intelligent program announced by presidential directive, as President Kennedy announced his Race to the Moon program, that I advocate. And the provision of the necessary federal incentives for conservation and for investment to let the free enterprise system get the job done. Now, in the field of research and development, the federal government must play the overriding role, the more exotic the field. You can't get private industry today to be interested in putting major investments into fusion technology. The government's going to have to do that because it's at least 30 and probably 50 years into the future. Similarly, in the solar electric cell, which is nearer to a breakthrough, you can get some private investment, but the government's going to have to do some there. And so it's a range of activity depending on how attractive it can be made in the near term to the free enterprise system that I advocate.
As a follow-up, would you support the Humphrey Hawkins bill that has the government looking for indicative planning to see which industries are necessary in the future, as to see where the problem areas are, and then have a government agency enter into the plans that you're talking about, just to subsidize the research and development that's necessary?
Well,
or would you support the Humphrey Hawkins bill?
I support the concept that this country should try to keep people at a level of full employment. I believe that we wouldn't even be talking about the Humphrey Hawkins bill if we had had an intelligent economic policy designed to deal with the energy crisis, which has been the reason that we have twice as many people as normal unemployed, and the reason for the huge inflation that we've suffered. It was the sudden quadrupling of oil prices, which created at least 50% of the inflationary thrust that led the government, by conservative fiscal and monetary policies, to throw people out of work to try to get inflation under control. Had we begun to invest in the energy program, we'd already have the alternative energy source on the horizon with which to compete with those prices, and more importantly, now that we've digested that one huge increase, we'd be prepared for the next one, which the Soviets are telling us they'll bring about right after the election in the Middle East, and we would have kept people employed at a level of full employment in order to get there in the energy field. Now, I advocate that our espousal of full employment ought to be through putting people to work on major national problems like the energy problem. And I believe that it was certainly unethical and maybe even immoral to try to make my monthly cost of living easier by forcing twice as many people as normal to be out of work. And I think there was a way to avoid it within the free enterprise system that would have produced lower national deficits than we have today, with the huge swollen welfare rolls and the great loss in income tax by people being fired and going on to welfare. Yes?
Yes, Admiral, in regards to your philosophy of treating the symptoms and not the disease, it would seem to me that the United States will require a large and responsive intelligence network. My question is, how do you see the role of intelligence agencies like the CIA in today's world, especially in light of the recent Senate committee hearings?
Well, I think it's clear that intelligence agencies are desperately needed. I think it's clear that more than one president of the United States violated the law and misused intelligence agencies to take vengeance against domestic enemies, political enemies, or at least, in the case of some presidents, to keep track of them. I think that by the time these practices were finally disclosed, we were pretty close to fascism in this country through the misuse of intelligence agencies. So I think the investigations were desperately needed. I think it's clear also that the Congress has been grossly irresponsible in the way in which they have conducted them. And I think that raw and unevaluated information has been leaked to the press, and this has been very harmful to national security, and at least one person to the public knowledge has been liquidated, and many agents have undoubtedly been liquidated as a result. If one ranked on the 1 to 10 scale the normal performance of the Soviets' KGB, I think you'd have to put them at about 8. And normally I think our CIA would range at about 6, given the problems of security in a democracy. I think today it must be down to about 1 or 2 because of the disaster that has befallen our whole network as a result of the irresponsible way in which Congress has investigated the illegal activity of presidents. Now, both bodies are venal in this respect, and the thing we need to do is get on with implementing the recommendations which are intelligent to set up a watchdog system to prevent future illegal activity by presidents and to get back into a covert mode to make it possible for our intelligence agencies to operate for our protection. Yes? I think the first thing that has to be done is the farmer has to understand the desperate problem his country is up against. That means the truth in packaging policy, so he understands. You didn't have any trouble getting automobile manufacturers to stop producing automobiles when we went to war, or the farmer to change his whole mode of operation. When everybody in this country understands what the Soviet objectives are, what they have accomplished by pretending detente while violating agreements one after another, you'll have the consensus for doing the necessary thing. Now, obviously, you've got to continue to make it possible for the farmer to have a livelihood. In my judgment, what that means is that the government is going to have to be prepared to stockpile the food excesses for that period of time that it takes to make the tough negotiations work with the Soviet Union. There is, in my mind, very little doubt that the Soviet Union will come to terms with us. They're almost contemptuous of us today for being such an easy mark. We have got to show that we're willing to negotiate toughly, and they will begin to toe the mark. And the grain is an important way of doing it, and insofar as the farmer is concerned, if it takes 3 years to get there instead of one, provided he is assured of a source of market, I think he will be even in normal times, prepared to support it, and when he understands what the facts are, like any good American, he'll recognize that the common good requires it. Each of us are selfish and have an instinct for our own self-interest. When that self-interest gets to the point of national survival, you have a common denominator that everybody can support. Yes?
Admiral, I can understand why the administration would not consider it politically feasible, or if we might consider it politically disastrous, to acknowledge the result of the detente violation in the election here. The question that comes to my mind is, I know that there are many members of Congress who would agree with you on national convention, which go right down the line with you. But so far as I've been able to pick up, the only news-making member of Congress who has spoken out at any great length in agreement with your views on the assault violation has been Senator Jackson. Now, is it that I've missed this, the press has not reported it, or why have not the rest of the why have not other members of Congress spoken out?
I think that members of Congress do have the impression that it still is politically unpopular to do so. I think that the political debate in this year is going to be a very important one to try to turn members of Congress around. When I was Chief of Naval Operations, I tried every year to visit with every member of the House and Senate. I averaged, as you know, Bill, about 350 of the 435 representatives and about 85 of the 100 senators every year. They broke down into almost equal groups of three. There was one third that would say, don't waste any time on me, I'm all with you, get out and get the others. There was another third that would say such things as, military power is irrelevant, or the switch would turn off as soon as you walked in. You couldn't convince them that military power was important. Unfortunately, you couldn't convince the Soviet Union that they were right, and they continued to exert it. But nevertheless, they were men of conviction. It was the middle third that used to bother me. That was the third that would say, look, I believe you, I'm worried too, but if I vote for you, I won't be here next time. And within that third, there was a subset that would go so far as to say, look, I've got to have a 70% anti-defense record next time. You tell me which 30% to vote for. And it was nice to have them in your hip pocket. We saved the Trident submarine on a 49-47 vote by casting some of those proxies. But think of the immorality of a man who didn't care what he voted for as long as I racked up for him a 30-70 record. And the only way you're going to turn that kind of man around, that middle third, is by convincing their constituencies that we're in deep trouble. And that's what I think the debate is about. And that's why I think it's important for both parties to have vigorous spokesman speaking up in this field. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been very patient about listening to this dialogue. Let me just conclude by saying that I personally am deeply optimistic about the future of this country. I reject totally Kissinger's tragic view of the future. I've been all over the country in the last nearly 2 years. I've spoken before all kinds of groups, including those campus groups that I told you about. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that the people of this country are ahead of their leadership. The last time that leaders had the guts to come to us when we were in this kind of trouble and report the facts occurred when President Harry Truman and the former isolationist Republican Senator Arthur Vandenberg teamed up and came to the public and said that detente with good old Uncle Joe had been a catastrophic failure. And they reported to us what it was that we had to do. And within 13 dramatic weeks, the country funded the Marshall Plan, supported the Truman Doctrine, created the National Security Act that made it possible for us to have the Department of Defense, the National Security Council, the CIA, the policy planning staff in state, and turned this disaster around. It can be done again once leadership begins accurately to report. The people are waiting to be told, and there is no doubt in my mind that they will support the truth when it is put out to them. Thank you very much.